Hello, and thank you for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. In today's episode, we discuss Section 475A and credit funds.
Okay, so welcome back to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Happy New Year to everyone. This is our credit fund series. We have issued about 20 of these so far. Some of the recent ones have been on the YA Global case. Continuing in that direction, we're going to explore some of the developments in Section 475 and dealer status of credit funds and the relevance of that to the industry. I'm Sam Riesenberg. I'm a Washington National Tax partner based in London and work very closely with our credit funds. With me, one of my W&T colleagues today is Josh Tompkins. Josh is an MD in our Financial Institutions and Products Group and also does a lot of work with our credit funds and has particular expertise in a lot of areas, including Section 475. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be here.
We have the YA Global case, I think, is the most recent development in this area. Obviously, it's a case about something related to credit funds, but it's not actually a credit fund per se. But they were issuing these contracts. We have a podcast on that. We'll include in the link. But one of the important pieces to this case and the holding of this case and the ultimate tax liability has to deal with Section 475. So with that, for the uninitiated, Josh, could you walk us through Section 475 generally so people that are familiar with credit funds can understand some of the nuances of that particular code section?
Yeah, absolutely. So Section 475, it's a code section that applies to dealers and securities. And that's generally defined as persons who are engaged in buying or selling securities from customers in the ordinary course of their business, or regularly entering into derivative positions with customers. So customer is kind of a key word there, and maybe we can get into that a little bit later. In terms of the consequences of being classified as a dealer, all securities held by the dealer are subject to mark-to-market accounting unless they've been identified out. And the mark-to-market gain or loss on those securities is going to be ordinary in character.
So thanks for that, Josh. So the question, I guess, is, so they found that they were a dealer, and we'll get into the customer piece in a second, but they found they were a dealer for Section 475 purposes, but not necessarily for other purposes of the code. So is being a dealer for Section 475 unique from some of those other areas? And should we take any stock of that distinction?
Dealer definition of 475 is obviously specific to that specific code section, but it does overlap in a number of respects with the definition of ordinary property under Section 1221A1. So I do think there is to some extent overlapping and interweaving rule sets here.
Right. So when we're setting up the definition of dealer, I think, and this will be an important piece of the section analysis when we talk specifically about YA Global, but even if you are a dealer, there's an election to treat some of your property as not associated with the dealer, so-called held for investment election. Can you walk us through what that is?
Yeah, that was a very important part of this case. And you're absolutely right, Sam. So a dealer in securities, like I mentioned, they're subject to market accounting on their securities and sell treated as ordinary. Now, that only applies if they have not been identified as held for investment or not held for sale in the case of loans. And so if a dealer makes that identification in their books and records, those securities would not be subject to these mark-to-market rules that we've been talking about. So that was very important. And in the case, YA Global attempted to make the claim that they did identify their securities. And maybe we can get into exactly what the court thought about that argument.
Yeah, for sure. Let's first turn to, as you noted, the issue of the definition of a dealer and concluding that they were a dealer by dealing with customers. Can you walk us through the court's analysis there and what surprised you, if anything?
It was sort of interesting, the tack that they took. Previously, the court, just for context, had concluded that YA Global was engaged in a trader business. They did not specify what type of trader business this was. But obviously, they were engaging in a lot of equity financing and debt financing transactions. And so the court said, look, we have a trader business. What we really need to meet this dealer definition is the existence of a dealer-customer relationship. And on that score, the IRS argued that we should look to Section 1221A1 as sort of our standard and analogous case law under that section. And under that rule, it defines inventory and dealer property as ordinary in character. And there's a lot of history there, and it sort of led up to some of the 475 rules, which is, I think, why the government thought that that would be an appropriate rule to look to for analogous case law. The court declined that invitation, and they determined that they could get there on the Section 475 statute and the regulations alone. And so how they did that is they looked at the Section 475 dealer definition, which really has two parts. There's buying and selling securities from customers, and there's also a second part where you're a dealer if you're entering into derivative positions with customers. So you can be a dealer if you meet either of those two requirements. And they looked at that second requirement and said, look, if you're entering into derivative positions with customers, you're a dealer. And the regulations related to that rule say that you have a customer relationship if you're holding yourself out as being willing to enter either side of a derivative transaction. And the court said, look, this is similar to what Wyatt Global's doing. They're holding themselves out as willing to provide capital to these portfolio companies. And we think that that same standard should apply for the other rule, which is, are they buying securities from customers in the ordinary course of their trade or business? And given Wyatt Global's standing in the market as a provider of equity and debt capital to portfolio companies in these pipe transactions, the court didn't really have a difficult time going from there to conclude that Wyatt Global was a dealer.
So that's interesting. I note that some commentators have expressed surprise at such a broad reading of the definition of dealer by taking the derivative specific rule and kind of applying it more broadly. Does that strike you as a particularly broad reading of the statute?
Yeah, it's certainly interesting that they looked to this other rule and kind of extrapolated it onto 475C1A rule. It's certainly interesting that that's the route they went and they didn't look to the case law. And the important element really of a dealer-customer relationship is there's sort of a service being provided. So if I go out and I get a mortgage, the bank's providing me a service and they're a dealer, even though they're buying the mortgage from me. It's a little bit different if someone has an opportunistic one-time investment in the company. And so maybe a takeaway from this is companies should look at how they're describing themselves to portfolio companies and their investors in the market. And does that sort of align with a dealer-customer relationship? I think, you know, in many respects, Wyatt Global's business model was quite unique. It may not apply terribly broadly across the industry, but it is something people should be thinking about.
So that's interesting. Associated with that key takeaway, there's a big piece, as we discussed, on the held for investment election and the analysis there. So could you walk us through the court's thinking on that?
This is sort of one of those issues where it's almost an unforced error in many ways, because this identification regime, it's selective, and taxpayers really, they just need to put something in their books and records making this identification. So it's quite easy to do. The IRS guidance on this topic has also allowed people to do it in reasonable methodology. So you could have like a blanket election that everything's held for investment or something like that. And Wyatt Global did not make a Section 475 specific ID. So they were left with arguing that their investment documents were sufficient to create an identification for purposes of Section 475. What I mean by that is there was language on the investment documents that said these securities are being purchased for investment or held for investment or something to that effect. And the court had to consider whether or not that was enough. And they ultimately decided it wasn't, and that you really needed something specific to Section 475. So those are kind of magic words in your identification statement. And the reason for that is when you think about the purpose of these identification rules, they want you to have an ID in place on the day you acquire security so that you're not using hindsight when you decide whether or not you want it to be marked to market. And anything ambiguous in the court's view would sort of allow taxpayers to argue after the fact that, oh, this wasn't an ID, or oh, this was. And so that was part of the reason for the court's ruling there. And so I guess maybe a takeaway on that point is taxpayers should A, get in place a protective 475 identification statement if they don't already have one. And again, that's another thing the IRS has explicitly contemplated in their guidance, is you can take a position that you're not a dealer and put in place an identification statement. And B, make sure that that identification statement is specific to Section 475. It kind of says those magic words. As demonstrated by this case, that's going to be important.
Well, that's obviously really important advice that people should be doing if you're a credit fund and thinking you're at any risk of dealer status and that you don't want. But obviously, that's a one-way election, right? So if you make that, make sure you know what you're doing, that you don't want to argue the opposite as well, isn't
yeah.
it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So certainly take that advice with guidance of somebody who's an expert like Josh. With that, Josh, any other key takeaways? This has been really informative.
Yeah, I think those are the biggest ones. So think about dealer status, how this case fits into your framework. And also, if you don't already have one, make sure you get that protective ID in place. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Thanks, Josh. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll be back with some more podcasts soon.
Thank you for listening to Talking Asset Management with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast and visit read.kpmg.us/talkingassetmanagement for more information.